welcome to another broadcast of Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Here he is, the smartest guy in the room, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show again. You know, tonight's title for this show is The Multidimensional Thinking. And wow, what a great lead in that new show, End of Empire, host Chris Bromish. I just tuned it in, and he's talking about vegetarianism, veganism. I'm talking about multidimensional thinking. From my own experience, I became a vegetarian. I was just thinking about this. It's going to be 40 years this summer. And, in the beginning, like a lot of vegetarians, you know, the whole idea of seeing a piece of meat in the store, suddenly it dawns on you what you're actually looking at. And I had that experience. Now it's just become second nature. You know, it doesn't faze me. It's just that I would never eat it personally. It's because it's just become so ingrained in who I am. I'm a vegetarian, not a vegan, actually, but I probably should be. And so that leads into this multidimensional thinking because, boy, oh boy, just think about it. I think about it all the time. What is reality? And we have all these kinds of thinking about what is reality. And it dawns on me that in some ways, the more we think about it, the further we get away from reality. I mean, Lao Tzu did famously say, I think the quotation or the translation that I know is, the more you know, the less you know. And which to me is true, because the more you know, the more you have things to question. And the more you have things to question, the more you can doubt. So the more you know, the less you know, because it's an expanding universe of knowledge. And as the knowledge expands, only more questions emerge. So the more you know, the less you know, because there are more doubts. And I could also say the more you think, the less you know, or the more you think, the farther you come from reality, which is, again, it's not that when Lao Tzu said the more you know, the less you know, he wasn't saying you shouldn't try to know, I don't believe. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try to think. I certainly love to think myself. But the more you think, the further you get from reality, because the more you think, the more boxes you create, the more opportunities you have to think outside the box, because you're constantly creating these boxes of thought. And this is, I think, a fundamental conundrum of reality. And multidimensional thinking, I mean, it's just, there's so many things that are unbelievable. I mean, who would have ever thought that in today's, right now in our election, presidential election cycle, that who would have thunk it, that Dennis the Menace and Grandpa Munster are actually strong candidates for president of the United States? I mean, who would have ever dreamed it? And we also have everyone's favorite, Marxist sociology professor, also right up there. Okay, I'm kidding. All right, but you know what? It's an amazing election. Who would have thought? And the thinkers, the pundits, surely got this election all wrong. Hillary was certainly predicted. That's not a surprise, but she was not predicted to have the competition she has in Bernie Sanders, and no one predicted Trump. And so it's just an unbelievable thing. Anyway, I'm not about to talk about politics here, but I am talking about thinking and what constitutes quote-unquote valid thinking. And maybe the notion of validity is the problem, because, like I said, I mean, we just get into boxes. Let's take logic, for example. Now, look, logic is a great thing, right? Logic is a wonderful thing. I would never argue in favor of illogicality. Logic is a good thing, a wonderful thing. But at the same time, having said that, like I said before, the more you think, the more boxes you form. Logic definitely is a great, is a wonderfully efficient box maker. I mean, logic is all about creating boxes, boxes of thought based on premises. You know, logic in the formal sense is basically defined, you might say, as, you know, it's deduction, and the conclusion is determined necessarily from its premises because there are defined implications. So you have premises that you derive a conclusion from, and they're defined. And so when we start developing systems, belief systems, systems of thought, not to mention ideology and dogma, but, you know, all of our thinking is based on premises, and they can be wrong, and they often are wrong. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be logical, but at the same time, you know, it's like gunpowder or even atomic energy. I mean, it can do great good, but it also can do great harm. And logic itself, thinking itself, can do that. I mean, at first you say, well, logic can do great harm. Automatically, you kind of revolt by that statement. Because am I suggesting you shouldn't think? No, I'm not. But the thing is, look how much damage thinking does in the world. Think of the things that are so idiotic that's been the result of thinking, and people really take it seriously, and they're willing to blow up the whole world because of their dumb, stupid-ass beliefs. Destructive, mean-spirited, hateful, prejudicial, awful things. So that can happen, all based upon thought. So the argument here is not about thinking, and I'm going to go over a whole bunch of, this is kind of a real free form today for me today, but it's really natural because to me, there are so many ways to look at thought, and all of them have some merit. That's the problem. But when they become too, unitary, monolithic, exclusive and then rejecting of any other point of view, that's when the problem happens. But then we have dogma, we have closed minds, we get into all kinds of problems. But here's the thing. Is it even possible to avoid that? Because everyone just wants to have their thing. Everyone wants to have their way of doing something. The scientists think that the non-scientific approach is just stupid and just wasting your time. I mean, I'm sorry, Dr. Michio Kaku, but I remember quite some years ago, and I really admire him greatly, but he was talking about, I think it was the book, I'm forgetting this particular book he wrote, but it has to do with, the grades of civilization and what levels we are. And then he thought extraterrestrials who would become visiting us who are very advanced, he would look, we would be very interesting to them. And as I recall correctly, Dr. Kaku sort of said they wouldn't really care much about our art. They would be basically interested. And if I remember correctly, excuse me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. Basically, he said the only thing they're really interested in is our scientific understanding and the level of our technology. And so therefore, all the art, it doesn't mean anything to them. See, I categorically disagree with Dr. Cox in that case. I don't know if he would still say this because, this probably was, I'm going to say, minimum 10 years ago, maybe a bit more than that. And I would think a highly advanced civilization, which truly advanced, would revere art, would revere the sense of expression of something that cannot be so nicely categorized and defined as, scientific, scientific, because science is based upon all these factoids. We have these facts, and we build things about facts, and science has tremendous, wonderful things. It's just that it cannot do everything except real art. Now, of course, that's an argument, too. I mean, with the singularity and technological advancement, the argument is, well, the computers will be doing art, too. Well, I'm not going to go down that road because I have a tendency to go all over the place, and so I'm not going to go there because it's just really a lot to cover. I mean, a lot of ways of thinking. And I would argue that every single one that we're going to talk about can be very dangerous if used with exclusivity. So why don't I just list something? And let me just list a few of these. Okay, so I already talked about logic. Okay, how about metaphor? Metaphor is a wonderful, wonderful way of thinking because metaphor, you know, it's sort of the Chinese expression, you know, a picture, you know, speaks a thousand words. Oh, by the way, I didn't say, Scott, back there, the producer, the engineer there, whenever I had said to him before, and I already, because my brain started going quickly, so I forgot to mention it. I want him to just, Scott, just feel free to jump in whenever you want. If anything I said, I have something you have some comment about, and including what I had or have already discussed. So feel free to jump in whenever.
I got you.
Well, okay, thanks, Scott. So I'm going to go down here. So logic, metaphor is like that expression, you know, a picture speaks a thousand words, because with metaphor, you have something, and then that one little something means like you can write a book about that little metaphor. So people who don't appreciate poetry, it's the same. They're not appreciating the power, you know, of a poem. And a few phrases can express something that can take volumes and volumes and volumes to actually get to the bottom of. And so I might argue that a world without poetry would be really, I mean, just think about just the word. I mean, just think of it. Just think of it. A world without poetry. I mean, when you think about it, I think of like a desert. It's, to me, it sounds like the end of civilization because the word poetry is itself a metaphor for, you know, the human sensitivity and human creativity and human imagination and human feeling. The word poetry is itself an incredible metaphor. Because, of course, you say, oh, it's poetic. So we have metaphor. Okay, intuition. I love that. Intuition is the exact opposite of logic. It just comes from the gut. And yet, if all you do is use your intuition, you're going to go down a path that, I'm sorry, will probably be a very, very unhappy one if you always only go by your gut. But if you never use your gut, you're probably going to be a pretty frustrated person, because then what you do is you only limit yourself to logical forms of thinking, and you miss out with that inspirational, metaphorical, poetic kind of aha. I know this doesn't make sense, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then you do it and you make the $1 million, or you create the wonderful idea, or the wonderful invention, or do the wonderful deed, because it escapes the little definitions, the tightly crafted premises that are part of logical thinking. So let's go to another. I just wrote something down. I just invented this term, so it's not quite nice, elegant, but assumptive qualifications. In other words, I'm talking about assumptions. Just like I was saying before, belief systems are based upon assumptions. It's like a deck of cards. It's like building, you know, the castle with dominoes. It's one assumption layered over the other, and we have to think by assumptions. But here is the thing. the human universe is a deck of cards, is a castle of dominoes that is ready to fall when they find the first nick in that essential domino or card that's holding up the entire edifice. Truly, because we know we're often wrong. I mean, science couldn't advance if it's not often wrong, because if it was right, they wouldn't have to change, right? But we're constantly changing. Of course, the thing is, the argument was, well, it's not a disastrous thing. Well, generally not. Our logical world seems to plod along and we escape. But, not really. Because all the awful things that happen in the world that could be avoided, it may not yet have been the total apocalypse, but it's certainly apocalyptic in many parts of the world. For them, the universe did come to an end. Mysticism, I've talked about it before in a topic. This is actually inspiration for this particular show, because I'm going to do a group meeting in a few weeks on mysticism and the singularity. As a matter of fact, I'll read you the title, because it's actually the inspiration for doing this show here. And the title is, Are Post-Singularity Scientific Visions the New Mysticism? So the singularity is the scientific or technological view that in about 30 years or so, machines are going to overtake human intelligence. And after that point, it's anybody's guess where it goes, because you can't extrapolate it, because the decisions are being made by machines, not by human beings. Well, anyway, some people really think that's going to be, the post-singularity is going to be really a great dawn, a great event, a great development, evolution for humanity. That's in some ways, that could possibly be looked at as a new mysticism, because now we have the magic of machines. We can do things and understand things that we couldn't possibly do before, and it's unimaginable by definition. That's what it means. And so much like mysticism, which we call the ineffable, the undescribable. You know, you can't describe God except by saying what God is not. So there's a certain similarity with the singularity, where you, don't really know what, you can't predict anything, because decision making is being taken out of the hands of human beings. And mysticism, where you're believing in something that you can't describe. So these are just all these paradoxes. I mean, this is the, in thinking, and I'm not opposed to anything. I'm not opposed to technology. I'm not opposed to mysticism. I'm not opposed to being emotional. Now, emotionalism, again, that's disaster, right? Anger. But what would we do without emotions? We would most likely lose our humanity. Emotions drive us. David Hume said the reason is the slave of the passions. So in other words, emotions were the motivators for us to do anything. We wouldn't do anything. We would have no desire to do anything we had no emotions. So emotions are really something fundamental in the substance of life itself, I think, the substance of consciousness. Yet, without logic and science and things like that, emotions would probably be a purely emotional species would probably be a very extinct species. It couldn't possibly survive. So, and then faith is another one I put down. I mean, this is like an Alice in Wonderland, looking through the looking glass. What is reality? You can take down, you can go down any one of these paths and run into oblivion. Now, my concept, which I discuss in my book, Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, is a concept of plural perspectivism. So that I try to get around it by what it means, because it means that you're constantly seeking counter perspectives, counter arguments. I mean, I really do believe in that so much, that we need to worship, if you will, you know, invite with great eagerness, you know, different points of view. And then, of course, I ground it in it, you know, one of the other major themes of the book is, of course, is the centrality of, you know, love, you know, in a very philosophical sense, that because that love, bounds it to something, so it doesn't become hateful, self-destructive to the self and to others. So anyway, this is what it's about. So there's all these different things, and my point is that every single kind, and this is scratching the surface. I mean, let's face it, I mean, I'm just scratching, there's so much more. I'm just scratching the surface here of some basic kinds of thinking that composite what I call, that can, you know, constitute what I call, what I've just decided to call multidimensional thinking. And the fact that you look at our ways of thinking, and then you realize how fragmented our notion of reality is. Because our notion of reality is usually through these singular, you know, these singular eyeglasses of this tunnel vision. Whereas I think that's that form of art. What was that called? You have any chance, you know, Scott? It's that kind of art where you look down and it shows you like all these different things going on at the same time. Cubism. I think it's called cubism.
I don't know.
I could be mistaken. Are you familiar with that, cubism?
I'll go with that. I honestly don't know.
Okay, I think so. I think it's cubism, and they're getting try to get the image of everything going on at the same time. You know, this is a common thing. You know, you two people are talking in a conversation, and it's just the world is defined by the context of let's say two people talking. But just think about what's happening in the world. Every single moment, all these things. Millions upon millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of events are happening, and the human brain is just designed to focus on this, little. I think part of it sometimes is called the species present. I believe the species present. Now, that's the exact moment, and there's so much more going on, and that's really reality. And so, you know, every moment is just maybe our reality, but that's only our reality from one perspective. There can be so many other different perspectives. And so that's why plural perspectivism, as I call it, is an attempt to mitigate, to somewhat soften. But I realize it's really impossible to really... I mean, I just think you have to be a superhuman to really are able to comprehend the multiplicity of perspectives, and then, I mean, you have to be a god. I mean, if there is a god, only God knows reality. And that reality, I would think, would be very, very different than our conception of it, because of the very multidimensionality of it. We're so limited by our senses, and then when we take our senses, by our concepts, and by our experience, and by our culture, and by our beliefs, and by other people who've influenced us, and by media, and by everything that happens in life. And so therefore, what is reality? Another one, of course, is meditation. I love meditation. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't really practiced it for a length of time, but I certainly admire it. I certainly think I want to get back into it. But the funny thing about meditation is, so many meditators are very, very fastidious. in their meditation techniques. And so, you know, they would go into the room where they meditate, and everything would be just right and just the same. And they would just follow that ritual of meditating. And yet, by meditating, it's thought that you can free the mind from, closed-mindedness, or free the mind to accept, open-mindedness to the world. And yet, the process of meditation is that very, very singular, very, very repetitive, very, very, repetitive practice. And so I think it's a little bit paradoxical that from that you would be able to open your mind to the diversity and escape the ego. But then again, probably not. I actually made that point, but somehow I think the point I made was not what the point I just made. There you go, because I had something in there, but right now, as I say that, it doesn't make much sense to me, although at one time it did. But then, of course, I think I was probably making a different point, which I have now forgotten. So, and let me make another comment, because we're going to take the break shortly, but when I talk about going back to logic and all that, even mathematics, I would argue, is just another perspective. Now, of course, mathematics is so elegant, and I'm not a Platonist. I mean, the debate in mathematics is mathematics actually part of reality itself, or is it actually just essentially a description of reality? I'm on the side of it being a description. I think even mathematics is only a certain very flexible way of describing quantitatively the way things are. It's a very deep debate among mathematicians, but I don't really think that the world is made of numbers. However, the world may be quantified into numbers, into digits, so that it comes very, very close to reflecting the way things are, but probably can't really get there. Before I take a break, what I said just reminds me of Zeno's paradox. So Zeno's paradox is several of them, but I think the most familiar one is where a runner or someone walking between point A and B can never get there. So let's say, Scott is, 5 feet from me, and I'm going to walk over to talk to Scott. I can never get there because, you got 5 feet. You divide that 5 feet, you have 2.5 feet. You divide that you get half of that. Then 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 you get half of that. So in other words, the argument is that distance and anything else can be divided, can be divided infinitely. So therefore, for me to reach Scott, I would have to travel an infinity of spaces, so I'd never get there. Well, I think, as most people agree, this particular paradox is wrong. But to me, it also shows you the limitation of mathematics, arithmetic mathematics, because numerically it makes perfect sense. It's just that reality does not match the mathematics. the reality of the mathematics, or if you want to call it mathematics, it's simple arithmetic, but that the arithmetic, the mathematics, and the reality are not the same. And so I think personally that is what's happened. However, having said that, division works very well. It suits us very well. It solves a lot of our problems, can do without it. But when we talk about reality, well, maybe not so much. Anyway, there's really a lot here to go on. Boy, there's all kinds of directions we can take. So we can take a break now and just stay tuned. We'll be back real shortly.
In Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, Arthur D. Schwartz presents an ethical theory that is a framework for evaluating moral conundrums that go beyond legalistic rulemaking, dogmatism, and preconditioned thinking. The book is as much an ethical framework for unconventional ideas as it is for staying with convention. Ethical Empowerment is a manifesto of non-doctrinaire perspective. Ultimately, the hypnotic thinking of ideology and dogmatism can only be overcome by returning to the true source and essence of morality, which is nothing less than universal love. Discover how the philosophically liberating approach of the ethical empowerment can be applied to the range of ethical, social, and political controversy. Read about a plan to eliminate all political parties. Entertain the possibility of an overhaul of the patent system and its replacement with a system that rewards inventors while eliminating monopolistic control of patents and technological suppression. Many other transformative ideas are discussed in the book, including issues related to the monetary system, real estate, scientific paradigms, and a rational approach to conspiracy theory. While ethical empowerment will challenge your mind to consider new perspectives, the ethical challenge is always to keep the diversity, depth, and breadth of perspective within the boundaries of love. Ethical Empowerment is available at Amazon.com and most online booksellers in both print and ebook editions.
This is Arthur D. Schwartz. You know, beliefs and disbeliefs can be very powerful. Much like philosophy, hypnotism is concerned with belief. Hypnotherapy, a practical application of hypnotism, may largely be described as the practice of removing false beliefs that form mental blocks to success, to happiness, and to well-being. In my hypnotherapy and philosophical counseling practice, I combine my work in philosophy with hypnotism in order to clear mental blockages that can occur on both conscious and subconscious levels. A mental block may be conscious or subconscious and can be expressed, for example, in the form of anxiety, low self-esteem or low motivation, bad habits, tobacco habits, weight gain, low performance, and much more. If you are interested in using hypnosis and the power of the mind to overcome mental blocks and barriers that have emerged in your life, please feel free to give me a call at 617-964-4800 or visit www.integralhypnosis.com. That's integralhypnosis.com.
Are you a person who enjoys intellectual social interaction and finds digging deeper into the nature of things, from big issues to everyday life, an important part of the pleasure of life? Social Philosophizers is a Boston area social club for those who desire intellectual socializing. It's a club for both singles and non-singles, and for anyone who finds intellectually mingling to be the best form of social mingling. The club offers a variety of interesting venues such as philosophical get-togethers in private venues, book discussions concerning literature and philosophy, topical discussions over brunch or dinner, guest speakers, theater, after-work mixers, even long philosophical ruminations along nature trails or city streets and more. If you live in the greater Boston area or occasionally spend time in the area, you can choose a cost-effective membership level that's right for you. Basic membership is free. Find the link on Arthur's Philosophical Perspectives show page at artistfirst.com or just search socialphilosophizers.com. We hope you'll join Social Philosophizers today. That's socialphilosophizers.com. Thanks for joining us on Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. All past shows are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Back to your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for standing by. Now, so my argument is you should be illogical, right? And not be a poet and have no intuition and be unemotional and don't have any assumptions and don't think about mysticism at all and don't meditate. or I could say, yes, we should be very logical. We should be very metaphorical. We should be very intuitive, very emotional. And we should always assume everything. Know the expression, never assume? Yeah, assume everything. Be very mystical. Always, always, always be scientific and always be faithful. Of course, all this is just a lot of nonsense, but it just points out what I'm talking about here is that I feel the only way to free ourselves from the boxes, the myriad boxes that make up human consciousness. We can't destroy the boxes, but we need to have those boxes interlinked so that we flexibly can go in and out of them and make use of the ones that are appropriate and ignore the ones that are not appropriate. And of course, that's a very, very hard thing to do. Probably the most important reason for that is because of that little thing called the ego. Because we get so attached to our ways of thinking. I made a comment here, actually on the little description I posted on the show page. I'll just read a little, tiny little description. Much as calisthenics can limber the body, thinking alternatively, unconventionally, and outside the box can limber the mind. Is the conception of mind equivalent to the conception of the unlimited? Well, I came up with that just when I wrote it because, you know, I really think that might be the case. Is the conception of mind equivalent to the conception of the unlimited? Maybe the mind, rather than its constructs like logic, like mathematics, like emotional concepts, or like assumptions, and like ideologies and other systems of thought. Maybe that the mind is much more than that. Maybe the mind is unlimited, like, for example, love can be unlimited. Now, love can be unlimited even though love is not infinite in all directions. In other words, the thing about love is that love would say love not. I mean, you know, I would say, you know, ethical thinking and morality itself is restrained by love. In other words, if it's not loving, it's wrong. I mean, in a, in you know, in an intellectual sense, That's my view of it. If it's not loving, it's wrong. So therefore, love is unlimited, but it does not follow every direction. And so that's not a paradox, really. It's unlimited in itself because there's no end to what love might possibly embrace. There's no end to what it might possibly not embrace. And I bring up love because I feel love and mind are closely interlinked. That's my view. That higher consciousness, if it is to be higher consciousness, must inevitably be loving. I know there are arguments against that, but that's just my point of view. Some would say, like with alien creatures, for example, Stephen Hawking had said it some, you know, not too long ago that, you know, the aliens, you know, may not be friendly. They might just want us for dinner. Well, some aliens might, but that because those aliens might not be, you know, not necessarily of higher consciousness. That actually would make my point that you can have very, very intelligent beings, but not very high consciousness. Well, for you know, certainly a purely computer-like being that has no emotion, but just is logical, let's say, and you know, it's just in our modern conception of programming, super computer, and that just calculates. That being can come here and can know how to speak, cross the light years, and maybe can create wormholes or possibly go faster than the speed of light, which could be possible. And but that doesn't mean it has higher consciousness, you see, because in my view, consciousness is not equivalent to thinking. As a matter of fact, thinking is in and of itself not conscious. Well, okay, now I'm running into self-contradiction, because I have all these things written about multidimensional thinking, logic, metaphor, intuition, emotional. So if I redid this, I would perhaps change the title to, say, multidimensional mind or multidimensional reasoning, even, because thinking generally does refer to something that's logical. Yeah, or not. I mean, it's what's the expression? You know, I'm being a little bit too particular. I'm using thinking as reasoning process, and I'm differentiating into different types. And so in that usage of thinking, there are a lot of things that I would consider to be have consciousness, require consciousness, and some that don't. So, this certain lack of words, really, I'm entering to territory where it's hard to describe, or the words kind of become adulterated with each other. But the thinking that a computer does today is not conscious in my mind. It's just calculating. It's just computing. It's just logically deducing, mechanically, like an adding machine. It's ultimately a very highly sophisticated adding machine. Conclusions. Now, but when we get to metaphor, well, metaphor can possibly, they're doing that now with artificial intelligence. So that still could probably be included as a kind of logic, very sophisticated logic, which is able to go through all the nuances. The problem is that some of the metaphorical stuff we have is really difficult to see being calculated. But okay, I'll go with that. I'll say it can be. Intuition. Now you got something there. I think intuition is something that's conscious. Now, again, I have to admit, I'm mincing words because I think a computer, you know, can become conscious, can become intuitive. But I'm not talking about, I have no problem with recognizing a computer that can do this. I'm just saying the machines we have today don't do that. And there's no sign that it can actually do that, can actually have true feeling, can actually truly feel pain. I mean, do people, you know, when you talk about conscience, how can you ignore pain? And how can it be even conceived that a computer experiences pain? And when we have intuition, intuition is one of those things that you go deep inside yourself. It's partly logic, partly feeling, partly emotion, partly something we know not what, except we just have a feeling. And those, you know, the word is feeling, really, that really brings down, that really makes the separation, I think, between a computer and a conscious being. I mean, the basic difference is, you know, that a conscious being has a way of knowing this is me and that's you, where a computer doesn't really do that. A computer, everything is just data, whether it's concerning its own processes or anything else in the world. There's no sense of recognition. That comes down to feeling. You feel as though you're something that's different than anybody else because you're that thing. You might have lots of things in common, but you're not that thing. And you feel that. And it's just, you can even say, well, it's the brain. The brain just, you know, creates emotions. The brain just creates, okay, good. That's what the brain did. Okay. But you haven't answered the question. What is feeling? What does love feel like? What does hatred feel like? What does kindness feel like? What does worry feel like? So I just don't see the computers today doing that. Now, again, I don't really have any problems with the thinking of a computer that could be conscious. I really don't. I think there will be. I mean, much science fiction it really comes to be true. And I think there's nothing that you have to be carbon-based or a biological entity to have consciousness. It's just that I do not think at the present time that scientists have a clue what consciousness actually is. Well, so this does have to do with a lot of this multidimensional thinking, because so much of it is exactly what I just said. So much of it is the things that go beyond the computing, that go beyond the calculation. They're these things that comprise the very essence of life and the very essence of the universe itself. And that's the problem with the truth. You know, once you state something as being true, you're opening yourself up for refutation. Because once you make the statement, theoretically it can be refuted. Because truth cannot be refuted. Truth is what it is. I have no doubt that there is truth. I have no doubt that there is reality, truth being something that is real. I just have problems knowing how I can be absolutely positively sure without any possible theoretical doubt that I can be wrong. And I can't be, anyone can be wrong. I mean, we can have lots of, that doesn't mean we can't go about our business and just believing and with certainty that things are the way they are. That's fine. I hope we have to live that way. It's just that once in a while, of course, we have the, oh my gosh, that's true? And that everything we thought was true now turns out to be false? You know what I mean? Mrs. Wood? I mean, suddenly you find out that what you thought didn't really, is not the case at all. And so that's the mystery of the world. And so that's where the problems with our multidimensional thinking comes about, because we're all just, any kind of thinking is essentially, not really, but in a sense, making a statement, making a proposition. Not necessarily in words necessarily. It doesn't have to be a logical statement or even a linguistic statement. But it can be just, an animal doesn't have language. I mean, most animals don't have any language, but they can still certainly in their behavior believe something is the case or something is dangerous to the animal. The animal might be fearful. The animal might want to attack because it thinks what's up there is the, or feels, I should say, what that the person approaching him, let's say a human being, is the enemy, when actually the human being is just trying to capture the animal so it can heal its wound. So the animal is not making a statement. The animal doesn't have the power of language, but it is in effect expressing a belief. And of course, in the example I gave you, that belief is wrong. Just like we human beings are very wrong. Just like logic has its role to play, but doesn't cover everything. Just like metaphors are wonderful, but sometimes metaphors are inappropriate. Sometimes intuition is incredibly insightful and eventful, and sometimes it's just the fool who listens to it. Emotions can be the mark of a madman, can be the mark of the irrational person who's not in control of himself. But sometimes emotions can save us, because emotions have motivated us, emotions have inspired us. Emotions have created, because of the motivation, wonderful things. And so many emotions of joy, of happiness, that bring us closer to the ineffable. So emotions are good and emotions are bad. Assumptions. Assumptions are necessary for existence. We have to make assumptions. But then they say, well, don't assume anything. Well, that's stupid. If you don't assume anything, then you're not going to be able to do anything, almost. You won't be able to engage in logical thinking. But then again, I would say don't assume everything. That's more logical. And then again, when you know, should I assume or not assume? The mysticism ideas. Well, I'm kind of a mystic in a way, but am I going to live my life with my mystical feelings? No. I think we can feel comfortable in feeling good about logic. I think we can feel comfortable about science. I think we can feel comfortable about a lot of things, about our beliefs. But we do need to be open, as Socrates said, to the unexamined life is not worth living. And so we have to always bring in doubt. And so there I come back to my plural perspectivism again. I would say that's very Socratic, except that it adds a little bit more of an eager pursuit to challenge your thinking. It's very hard to do that. Very, very hard to do that. Try, friends, to challenge your thoughts, your dearest thoughts, just to get the opposing view in there. It would be almost impossible to do. You don't even want to think that way. It feels like it's repulsive. And I'm not saying that would go in the other direction, but I'm saying that to do that is really quite a challenge. And at the best, it will only sharpen our beliefs. but also maybe at the best, it will also modify it somewhat. We learn certain loopholes, certain imperfections and blemishes in our thoughts. So anyway, and then let me talk about faith, which I've talked about before. And so faith is really very important. Faith is that thing that we can really believe. And that faith begins to tie together all of the kinds of intuition and the kinds of beliefs, and creates the opportunity for, I'm looking for something here, creates the opportunity for looking for coming up with wonderful ideas just by faith alone, because faith provides a wonderful thing in the mind that through belief makes it true. And sometimes we need have faith. But then again, sometimes our faith is disappointed. So once again, even faith is has a little trickery involved. It's not that we shouldn't have faith. It's just that sometimes we can have faith and realize, well, I had faith in that, but I was wrong. Or I had faith in that, it didn't work, but I still think it's right. Well, in any case, that I think at this particular point, Scott, does conclude our program. These were just some thoughts I had about multidimensional thinking and the world as a big, in some ways, just a big illusion. And that with all this illusion, somehow we have to grasp at the things that get us through. And with faith, hopefully, those that confidence becomes stronger and stronger with time. And so this does conclude tonight's broadcast. For links to my book, Ethical Empowerment, My Philosophical Counseling and Hypnotherapy Practice, and the Social Philosophizers Club, please visit arthurdschwartz.com. Before I finally close, I do want to let folks know that in the Boston area, on it's going to be on Thursday, May 5th, we're going to have a creativity mixer being sponsored by my three groups, Social Philosophizers Club, the Philosophic Perspectives Radio show meetup site, and the Creativity Expo. So if you have a chance, check out any of those sites and you'll get the information. The Creativity Mixer, Thursday, May 5th. And so this is Arthur D. Schwartz now reminding you to live well and think deeply. So until next time, good night, everybody.